A word of warning.
Whatever you say will be broadcasted. All the mics are open.
So when you lean over to the left and chat with Warren, the world will know what you're saying. Thank you for coming. It's very nice to have you here. We will have, I hope, open and candid and good discussion. I joined the board 6 years ago, and the second topic on the first board meeting was revenue. And I was a little bit shocked by the discussion, and I was further shocked when I learned that the exposure draft would be published in October 2004. Well, a lot of things have happened since, and we have discussed a lot of different alternatives. And then in the end, we got an exposure draft out, as you know, slightly different than what we had as a direction 2004. I think that is good that we try the limits of thinking. And now, April, we got something 950 letters or so to read. 250 of them are identical, so I promise to read all the 250 very carefully. And I think we board members try to read all the letters, and after a while you recognize some of the arguments, so then it's a little bit quicker reading perhaps, but I think it's very important for us. But we've also had a lot of other outreach, as some of you might have noticed. I think we've had more than 200 different events, sometimes one-way communication, sometimes intense discussions, sometimes with the general public, sometimes with special interest groups. We have April Henry, Kenny and Glenn here of the team to guide us through the project and today. We still have the ambition of closing this project with a new standard mid-2011. And of course that will depend on comments given today and then the other, what we have, 7 or 8 similar events, and of course reading the letters and other discussions. We hope we'll get in the November meeting either a brief summary or a more work through summary of the response letters, but it's hard for staff really to summarize so many different letters given. So now we have until 11 o'clock, and the idea is that we will spend some 15 to 20 minutes on each of the topics that have been selected. Hopefully the topics are selected to more or less comply with what you have brought up. We have allowed a little extra, few extra minutes for the control part, which is something we feel is very important. And towards the end, we will allow all of you for a short last word to us before we break up the meeting. But before we start, why don't we go around the table and everyone makes a quick introduction, who you are, where you come from, and hopefully also a word or two about your expectation of this meeting. If I start, I'm John Engström, I'm a board member here. My expectation is that you will tell us a little bit more in detail some of these topics, and the expectation is that we board members will be more on a listening mood than in a defense mood.
And good morning, my name is Kenny Beeman, FASD staff. And we actually had a very similar meeting to this last week in Norwalk, and we received a lot of very good input, and I expect to hear the same today.
Good morning, I'm Andrew Watchman from Grant Thornton International, and I would expect to just have a chance to expand and clarify on our comments in our comment letter and to hear the range of views around the table.
Stephen Cooper from the ISB.
Veronica Poole, Global Managing Director for IFRS Technical at Deloitte, and my expectation for this morning is to share some of our key thoughts on the subject and hear the views around the table.
Bertrand Perrin from Vivendi. I'm located in Paris. Vivendi is a media and telecom group, and I'm in charge of accounting standards with the accounting department, and our expectation is to get precisions on some concepts that are described in the ED.
I'm Larry Smith from the FASB, and my expectation is that all of you will give us the answers to go forward.
Henry Reese from the ISB staff, looking forward to hearing your comments and particularly your suggested solutions to the issues.
Robert Overend, I'm a member of the UK Accounting Standards Board. I'm not sure whether we've got any answers this morning, but I'm interested in hearing all the views around this table.
Yes, Richard Martin, Head of Financial Reporting at the ACCA. Likewise, really, I'm here to expand on anything we've said in our letter and to hear what the other views.
Warren McGregor, a member of the International Accounting Standards Board, and I'd like to hear an elaboration of the views that you set out in your comment letters and on those tricky issues. We all know what they are. Your input would be very valuable to us in trying to resolve those as we move forward to a final standard.
I'm Stuart Lowell from Balfour Beatty, representing a group of leading UK construction and support services companies. And our industry, which is largely concerned with developing complex, tailor-made assets over long-term contracts, has some particular issues with the proposals, although we support the intention of the ISB to produce one revenue recognition standard.
Ali Mislan, Association of Accounting Technicians. Two things. One, to hear the views of all the other people. Second, I think to get to a really workable standard, a uniform and workable standard.
Yeah, I'm Wei Guo from ISB. My main purpose to come here to listen to you how to make trade-off between principles and guidance, you can say the operational guidance, especially the industrial-based guidance.
I'm Philip Holmes from Cooperatives UK. We're the trade association for the cooperative movement in the UK. Expectations today are to inform you a little bit more about cooperatives, which is much misunderstood, and obviously when you do draft a lot of these standards, it doesn't seem to take into account that cooperative viewpoint. So hopefully we can allay a few of those misconceptions this morning.
I'm Tony DeBell, partner at PwC. I'd like to hear how other folks have addressed some of the more tricky issues in the proposals and be pleased to elaborate as far as I can on what we had to say in our letter.
PK from IASB.
Glenn Brady from the ISB project staff.
April Pittman, ISB staff. Looking forward to what I hope will be a lively discussion this morning.
Before handing over to April, let's agree that we keep the microphones open. I think that this makes it easier. If we are lucky, we can be a little bit informal, perhaps, and I will note who is sort of seeking to speak. Otherwise, the technique of raising the name tag so I can see who would like to speak. And with that, April, I hand over to you.
Okay. Well, we've arranged the agenda today to concentrate on those topics which the majority of you requested we discuss today. As Jan said, we'll try and follow the agenda fairly informally, but we do want time at the end for each of you to sort of summarise your views or your suggestions or to raise any topics which are particular to you and which haven't been discussed. And I know Philip has a point which we haven't come across before, and which isn't on the main agenda as it is unique to cooperatives. Now, we hope to hear as many views as possible, so in discussing a topic, if you agree with the previous speakers, it would be helpful if you just say so and then go on to make any further remarks that you would like to add to that discussion. And in that way, we'll get through as many individual points as possible in the course of the roundtable. As Jan said, the roundtable is being webcast, so it might be helpful if each of you could please state your name and your affiliation when you speak, and that will make it a bit easier for the listeners to follow. Looking at the agenda, the first item on the agenda is control, which was requested by virtually everyone. There are spare copies of the agenda if you haven't downloaded them as yet. Pass them around to Richard. Now, there are extracts from the ED on the agenda. The principle, as you can see, is that revenue is recognised as the goods or services transferred to the customer. And saying that, we use control as a tool there to say when that happens. And saying that occurs when the customer receives a finished good actually works quite well. But we notice in the comment letters and elsewhere that some people have difficulty in visualizing control as it applies to services, and also difficult to apply what they think of as control to a part completed work in progress. Now, it may be that we need to supplement the sort of indicators for control so that we include more about services, or perhaps clarify what conditions are relevant for a continuous transfer of control in accordance with the model. So we've put a couple of discussion points, but obviously feel free to raise any you want. Is use of control useful in determining when the transfer has occurred? Does the control principle help you, and do the indicators support that principle well? How would you apply it to service contracts, or what characteristics do you think a contract would have to indicate that you had continuous control? I don't know if anyone would like to kick off on this particularly.
Can I go first? Hi, Tony DeBell from PwC. I think from our perspective, the important thing is that the trigger for revenue recognition reflects when the supplier has done what it has to do and the customer has received what it expects to receive. And we think that the principle of control in a lot of cases is going to get there. So I think we generally support using the principle of control, and we think the indicators in the exposure draft work well for the sale of goods. Our sense is it's probably not quite as clear when you're looking at services. I think there are a couple of issues around services that it might be worth thinking about. So, for example, a transportation service. Is control transferred as the goods move across the Atlantic or when they arrive in New York? If a lots of questions around the table, if there is a professional delivering a report, is the control transferred as the report is being written or the research done, or when the report is signed or issued? And so we wondered in that context whether it would be helpful to have one or two more indicators that focus specifically on control. So, for example, we wondered about whether you might look at, you know, has the customer benefited immediately from what's been done? So you can see the customer's got what it is they expected to get. Or has the work that's been done, it builds on the previous task or the previous step, and therefore somebody coming new to it wouldn't have to do that work again. So if, for example, the supplier didn't finish the contract, the work that was done wouldn't have to be repeated. And we wondered whether those would be helpful. And if you sort of move on, I think you asked April about continuous transfer for example, long-term contracts or construction contracts. We wondered whether the guidance around that might focus on whether the substance of the arrangement is that the contractor is working under the direction of the customer. So again, as the contractor carries out its work, the customer is getting the benefit as it goes along rather than at the end. So overall supportive, but we wonder if one or two more indicators might add some clarity.
Veronica?
I agree with Tony that I guess control is the right approach overall, but the articulation of control as it applies to services perhaps could be improved. And one of the ways that we were looking at how one could elaborate on that principle is by looking on who is going to determine what is going to happen to the goods or services in their present state. Who has that ability? So, for example, if you apply that test to customer-specific goods that are delivered on the seller's premises, then what do you look at? What can the seller determine? Can he sell, for example, those goods to someone else? And if they are customer specific, quite often that would be impossible. So that would help you determine where control lies. Equally, if these are not customer specific goods, then what you will actually then see is that the seller is in a true position to determine what happens to the goods in their current state. Applying to that principle to the services, if you are actually looking at the delivery of an audit report or a legal service, partway through that service, it is something that the seller, the service provider, cannot generally just take away entirely from the customer. So you need to see what happens in that case, you know, who is determining what happens to the partway completed audit or to a partway completed legal suit. So that's the way we kind of were elaborating around that principle in our letter and gave you a few examples in that respect. One of the things that was occurring to us as we were looking at this, there are certain combinations of those indicators that you listed that would always get you to conclude the control lies with a particular party. And I think it would be very useful to give those examples demonstrating that certain combinations would always land you in a position of control. And ultimately, there are a few other clarifications that would be very useful. So, for example, is physical possession absolutely necessary in order to determine that somebody has the control? So the ability to take physical possession of the goods at any point in time, is that necessary? So think of the advertising services. The customer doesn't really get the possession, the physical possession of the advertisement that's going to be broadcast on the television. So is it therefore not customer specific? Who is in control there? So, and I think those clarifications would be very useful.
Okay. Thanks, Larry Smith. we had a similar roundtable last week in Norwalk, and it seems like one of the difficulties is just trying to explain the concept of control, particularly as it relates to service contracts or long-term construction contracts. And one of the participants at the Norwalk roundtable, and they indicated this in their letter, said, you know, it would be great if you can take that concept of control and embellish it with more indicators or what have you to really explain what you meant in relation to service or long-term construction contracts. But at the end of the day, it might be difficult to get there, and therefore maybe you should just develop a second model, if you will, for service contracts or long-term construction contracts. And I guess I would ask for your reaction to that, because it just seems like we're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole somewhat to deal with these types of contracts. You know, when it pertains to audit services, for example, at the end of the day, the customer, unlike a long-term construction contract where the customer has a lot of say in terms of the development or the design of the particular building and the options, et cetera, in an audit service, I don't think the customer tells the auditor how to audit whatsoever. And really, the customer doesn't really receive anything until they get that audit report, I mean, from a practical standpoint. Yes, they get this intangible, you know, comments about internal controls or what have you, but what they're looking for is the audit report. So I would just ask for some of your reaction as to whether really we're really trying to accomplish something that isn't really very achievable.
Thanks, Andrew Watchman, Grant Thornton. In picking up on Larry's question, like other speakers, we said in our letter that we do support control as a starting point, but we do see it really in those terms. It's a starting point. It's a framework within which to develop some more detailed and specific application guidance for different types of arrangements. On the question of services, I think I would echo some of the sentiments that Larry's passed on, that it does seem very difficult to actually articulate in a principle-based way how you get to control transfer in the context of services. Our suggestion, which won't be to everyone's taste, I know, but nonetheless, it's our suggestion on pragmatic grounds is to basically presume that control is transferred in a service contract continuously unless there is clear evidence to the contrary. And those words could be finessed, but a presumption of control. I think one or two other commentators suggest a similar approach on what I'll call long-term contracts rather than construction contracts, that just presume that control is transferred continuously. In the context of real estate contracts, so I hope that IFRIC 15 has this idea of continuous control, albeit interpreting different standards right now, and is not proving straightforward to apply. Some jurisdictions are just rejecting it anyway, but others are arguing vehemently on different interpretations. So, again, a rebuttable presumption of some kind might be an avenue to explore.
Yes. Richard Martin from ACCA. I think that one of the things that you would, if you're going to develop it further, you would need to decide clearly is whether we are viewing things ultimately from the customer's point of view or from the the supplier's point of view. And one would think in a revenue recognition standard, you should be looking at the suppliers. As a supplier's point of view, it's the supplier's accounts, and it's their financial statements. But I think actually the concept of control, if you're going to pursue it, is about to me ultimately I think is in the end a customer point of view. And so I think that if you were applying the control model to some of these difficult cases like the provision of transport services and consultancy contracts and so on, you would need to quite clearly say that it is, to the extent that the customer has probably gained some benefit, that is the basis on which they have gained control over the service. I think you would say that. So yeah, it's the clarifying the customer supplier is, I think, I think the heart of it.
And Richard, do you think that partway through sort of the long construction process, would the customer have obtained any benefits, do you think?
I think, we need to think about examples here. I mean, I think the real estate construction, I suspect they probably have gained benefit. There is something being built there, and in many cases they will have something if it all goes wrong. I'm not sure the sort of building accounting standards on what if it all goes wrong and the supplier goes bust is necessarily the right way to do it, but it is a way of looking at it. I think on things like the provision of customer specific software, the audit and things like that, I'm not sure they've gained any benefit until the process has been completed. So that I think some of these would then fit clearly fit into the model that it is on the final delivery of the report and so on is when the customer gains the benefit, and that's when the revenue should be recognised. So that would be a clear answer. Whether people feel that might be the right answer or not, I don't know, but I think it's got quite a lot of merit to it.
Stuart Lowell, UK Construction Support Services Contractors. I think I agree with most of the general points that people have made around here. Picking up the specific construction aspect, and that's not just pure construction, it really applies to any long-term assets, for instance, aerospace, for instance, defence as well. I think, and responding to the last point, on the point about if the supplier goes bust, I mean, that's certainly a useful way of looking at it. But you could also look at it from the other perspective, because in our view, where you have a contract, if the customer terminates the contract, which it may wish to, for whatever reason, unsatisfactory performance, or it wishes the project to develop in a different way, for instance, which can often happen. If the customer terminates the contract, if the entity performing the work is paid up to the date of that work, and the customer obtains the benefit of that, that could itself be a useful indicator of continuous transfer of control. And it would address another issue,
which if you look at criterion A, for instance, customer has an unconditional obligation to pay. That's a little problematic to interpret where you're paid over 3 or 4 years on stage payments. Because what will typically happen is the customer or his agent will certify the work that's been done and the entity will be paid. But ultimately, if the hospital or the school or the missile system doesn't work, the customer can get all the money back. Clearly, I think the customer's had benefit, but you would actually fail that test. A couple of other construction specific issues. Customer has physical possession. That's a little difficult where you've got a subcontract arrangement. Most long-term contracts, construction or otherwise, will be done by a main contractor with many subcontractors. Often the work will be done on the customer's land, but if you look at it from the perspective of the subcontractor, the subcontractor's customer is the main contractor who wouldn't have physical possession because it wouldn't be their land and they wouldn't have legal title either. So there's some difficulty there. This one is the general point about carving out specific indicators for construction and or services. I think if that is the only way that you can get something that is workable, obviously I think we would support that. But we would prefer to have one all-embracing standard because there is a danger of having bright lines and exceptions. And the boards have made enormous progress, in our view, in addressing the concerns that we and the Australian contractors and other contractors raised at the discussion paper stage. And I think you're to be commended in where you have got to. And with a little bit more effort, it may be possible to produce an all-embracing standard, which I think would be much better for accounting and in general, I think. And those are my points.
Robert Overend from the ASB. I guess we're possibly slightly less enthusiastic about control, as you probably gathered from our letter, than some of the speakers this morning. I guess control clearly works well in certain cases, and we all know and recognise where those are. I guess the problem is where control works well is probably where we don't currently have problems with revenue recognition anyway. So this brings you back to are you actually helping? I think when you get into the area of services, and I agree with a number of points that both Andrew and Richard have made, there's control to me and to a number of my other board members doesn't work as well. And there are obviously ways in which you can solve that problem. Andrew suggested a sort of rebuttable presumption. That is clearly a solution. It's a way of making an accounting standard to resolve the problem. But it's not clear to me that is actually really helping you in terms of control. It's effectively saying we think revenue should be recognised on service contracts in this sort of way. It's not really answering the fundamental question as to whether or not anything that I could control as a customer. I guess Larry's point about the audit report, it seems to me, is a fundamental point on that one. That to what extent has anything meaningful been transferred to the client during the process of the audit? I personally would argue not at all. They want the audit report. I'm sure our internal control reports and board reports are hugely valuable, but what they actually want is that audit report. Just as Tony's example at the start, what they want is the good to arrive in Rio de Janeiro, not to sort of sink somewhere mid-Atlantic. And I think that I guess underpins a lot of the concern that we expressed in our letter.
Just to come back on some of the points and on Larry's question, one of the things you asked Larry as to whether it would be useful to carve out the specific indicators for the construction industry to try and address some of the more complicated points, and I very strongly agree with one of the previous speakers to say we should try and come up with one comprehensive set of principles that could apply across all industries and across the provision of goods and services. One of the things that is worth probably considering is when you are looking at the provision of that audit. And just to come back to some of the things you were saying a minute ago in terms of, is the delivery of an audit, is it a delivery of a good or is it a delivery of a service? And perhaps one of the things which equally applies in the construction industry and was articulated very well by the construction industry representative here is that what you actually are looking at here is the fact that if that contract was, for whatever reason, stopped by the customer, I think it's important to understand that at that point, I think most of the provisions of that contract or the courts would view that as something has been delivered, something beneficial has been delivered, and there has been a performance by the seller, and therefore the seller would be appropriately awarded a commensurate reward and would be paid. So I think the principle needs to be absolutely articulated around the fact that the customer in those cases cannot actually avoid paying the seller, and therefore that in itself should be one of the indications of the fact that that is perhaps specific, and perhaps also the fact that the control was indeed with the customer, whether you define it in the terms of the benefits, whether you define it actually in the terms of the indicators that you have used, articulated perhaps a bit more comprehensively applying to the service.
If a good was I contracted to have a good delivered in London, and that good was coming from America, and it got on the ship and got halfway across the Atlantic and never made it to London, would that customer have to pay? And do you think, I mean, perhaps your view is that transportation services ought to be on a completed contract basis, and if that's your view, fine, but I'm pretty certain there probably are people in the transportation industry that wouldn't agree with that. But, I mean, that's the way I would interpret that.
The way I would see that, it would very much depend on the terms of the contract, in terms of what it is you are actually agreeing. Whether the fact that the good is lost midway through the Atlantic and never arrives in London, whether that means, therefore, that there hasn't been a delivery, would be a very good, I guess, provision that would be very much covered in the contractual terms. If that was not clear, I don't think I would know what I'm doing under those contractual arrangements. I would know what I had actually agreed to provide, whether I had actually agreed to provide the transportation service that involved paying by mileage or delivery of a good. Equally, you know, you would probably find that in that situation, if the good never arrives, then the contract specifically articulated that the delivery has to be in London and no payment will be made if the delivery doesn't happen in London. Well, that's, here we go. I think that gives you your answer. So maybe it is worth looking on what would happen if the delivery doesn't happen.
Yeah, I was in contact. I owned a good in America and in London. I was just contracting with the transportation company to deliver it to me.
Yeah, I think to go back to the point, I echo what Stuart and Veronica said, that we would very much prefer there to be one model. I think one of the issues that we have applying the standards as they apply today is the tension and the arbitrage between there being two fundamentally different models, and that I think the proposal is a big step forward to dealing with that arbitrage. IFRIC 15 was a solution in one set of circumstances. But we still struggle with the tension between two different models, and we think that control can address that. And I think it does depend a lot on the facts and circumstances, the terms of each contract. So the fact that the buyer can specify what the supplier does may well work in some construction situations and indicate that control is transferring as you're going along. But that might not work in other circumstances. You might say in the context of a professional services report that the customer is benefiting either because that work doesn't have to be done again or because there is some sort of interim delivery. With transportation, if the ship sinks, as Veronica says, you'd have to look at the terms of the contract. But if I'm being paid by the mile to drive it from New York to LA and I get halfway across the continent, then you don't have to drive it that halfway. So I think there will be the argument in that case that you have actually received the benefit of getting it halfway across. So I think we'd very much prefer there was just a single model, and we think that by clarifying the indicators, you would be able to address most situations.
Well, some people will argue that having your car halfway from New York to Los Angeles parked on a shopping center would be a negative value, but
possibly.
Okay.
I think wanted to ask a different question on the control, just to get some idea. I very much enjoyed the conversation so far. The indicators that we have in this control are based on the customer getting control, but the revenue is recognized in the books of the vendor, not on the books of the customer. We had this discussion last week in Norwalk on the same lines, and we got some healthy feedback on that. Wanted to understand, if we change the control indicators rather than from customer obtaining to the vendor discharging, at the end of the day, revenue is nothing but a derecognition of an asset in that sense of the word. So wanted to understand or wanted to get some thoughts, what happens if we change the control indicators to from the vendor, like a discharge? What would be your reaction? Will there be any contracts you would think of which will be captured, which would otherwise not be captured? We got some examples last week in Norwalk and wanted to see if there's any thoughts here on the table.
I didn't want you to interrupt the discussion. That's
okay.
So,
and I want to jump on PK's question.
If I can just answer to that.
Okay.
Probably with at Vivendi, Bertrand Perrin from Vivendi, we think that the transfer or the control notion based on the perspective of the customer is fine within our businesses. We are not concerned by this discussion that mostly concerns long-term service companies or construction companies. And so probably we would be disturbed in some instances, in some aspects of our businesses on revenue recognition if it was control notion was based from the vendor's perspective and no longer from the customer's perspective. For instance, what about failed sales, for instance?
What is that?
Failed sales, for instance. What about it? When you sell a goods and you sell a service subsequently to the goods, and you have a date of activation, for instance, you need to activate something on the internet or to a customer service client or whatever. So what happens then? So not that confident. Probably it works fine if we stick to the customer's perspective rather than the vendor's one.
Okay.
And I wanted to add something that it's something totally different. So maybe at the end, I take my chance. And in terms of application to service contracts, also it's a side question, probably by comparison to the core control notion. But if the provisions of the ED could be probably precised, or if there could be a more explicit link between these. A control transfer notion and the agent principle notion. We think under current ED provisions we have sufficient guidance to conclude, but probably to seek better comparability between companies, it might be useful if we could know, okay, we transfer control, customer gets the control of the goods or services sold, and then how does the transaction price share between, for instance, a content provider and an internet provider.
I just wanted to go back to Tony's point about the control and the legal aspects of that. In particular, in terms of the construction contracts, because you do have cases where large construction contracts, they could be viewed as continuous, but then you also get turnkey contracts, which could be viewed as not continuous, and that controlling passes when the contract is actually finished, completed. And then control is passed to the buyer, the customer. So you have a complete, if you like, a contradiction within that. And that would, it's actually crucial in determining control.
Okay. Did you want to come in, Robert, or you took it down?
I'll come back later.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, picking up the point the last speaker made, I think if you view this purely as control, I think that's absolutely right in a turnkey construction contract, which is, I suppose, why we have the issue with how it's phrased. If you look at whether the customer's obtained benefit, however, I think the customer has obtained benefit. I mean, what is the use of a half-built hospital? Well, the use of it is that the customer could terminate this contractor and bring in another one to finish the work. It's not that the customer is not capable of receiving any benefit. And I think the issue for me is that, and responding to PK's interesting challenge, I think it is correct to focus on the customer, because ultimately, whatever you like to book in your accounts, you haven't actually got any revenue unless the customer is ultimately going to pay you, and it's only the customer who's going to pay you. So I think it is correct to look at it in that perspective. And if you take it from the other side, you could have as much activity on site as you like, but if you don't actually build what the customer wants, he isn't going to pay you, which is why I think the boards are right not to use the activity-based model. What use is a half-built hospital? What use is a half-finished audit? As I say, certainly in the case of a hospital, I think there is use there. I think the other issue for me is that I think just having four indicators where two of them clearly don't apply to services is just not enough. I think Tony proposed another indicator that the customer directs the activity. That would certainly work in some circumstances. It wouldn't work in a lump sum turnkey contract, because by definition it's the lump sum turnkey contract. The customer doesn't want to direct it. He just wants a hospital. He doesn't care how it's done, but it's a useful indicator. We suggested one. I think you just need a wider range of indicators, perhaps focusing on benefits to the customer as well as whether they actually control it, which is a much narrower concept. And then you would probably get a range of indicators that would be helpful. And it's a bit like it's the old story that it's very difficult to unambiguously define a rhinoceros, but you'll know one when you see it. So if you have enough indicators and they are apposite, then sensible people will look at the range of indicators and come to the same view as to whether something qualifies or not.
Yeah, just to I would agree very much with what Stuart said. I think in answering the two questions that have been sort of posed to us, I think you should stick with one model for revenue recognition. So I support what the other people said. I would also say, I think, though it might seem a strange, I think from the supplier's point of view, you should not use the supplier's point of view for your main indicators. Control is about what the customer benefits, and I think you should stick with that. I think it injects a degree of caution on the recognition of the revenue, which I think is a good idea. All our major problems in accounting failures have often been about the recognition of revenue too early and on an unjustified basis. So that I think that the transfer of benefit to the customer is the key thing. Warren?
Just a couple of questions, if I can. Andrew, rebuttable presumption approach. I always worry about rebuttable presumption approaches. It sort of means it's all too hard to really deal with. So I'm going to ask you a question. Is the audit report an example where you would rebut the presumption?
Well, an audit is a service, so we would start with the presumption that control is transferred continuously. Yeah, I by no means profess that a rebuttable presumption is ideal, partly because I think you can self-select as to how hard you try to work in making the rebuttal. But I nonetheless think it's perhaps more practical than trying to potentially apply the square peg in a round hole control to services model that Larry's mentioned already. Would I rebut the presumption of an audit report? Probably not. For reasons already given, I think the client does receive, like to think anyway, working for a global accounting firm, that the customer is receiving value over the course of the audit. And if the customer chose to change the auditor, then they probably have to pay something for the work done so far.
It's interesting. I'm not sure you get a lot of brim around the
table, but
I'd be interested in knowing what Tony says, because I think, Tony, you did give the example, well, if you've done some work, that work's done and wouldn't have to be repeated. So would you agree with
I wouldn't agree with a rebuttable presumption. I think rebuttable presumptions are generally inconsistent with principle-based standards, so I would want to try and work with a principle rather than a rebuttable presumption. I think in some circumstances with audits, yes, you would be able to say that work has been done. It wouldn't need to be done again. The auditor is going to be paid for it. So if you're looking at it from the customer's perspective, the customer has received the benefit of work that doesn't have to be done again. Now, I know that you could look at different professional courtesy rules on whatever it is around the world about the extent to which an incoming auditor might have to repeat some of the work. But I think there is, based on the law, based on the terms of the contract, I think you could make the argument in some cases. Maybe there are some cases in which you couldn't. But I think we would very much prefer to have a principle and some indicators that we can apply than a rebuttable presumption that says it is always this or it is always that.
Can I just ask Robert a question too? You, I think, were critical of in the submission and your comments on the use of the control notion, particularly in the context of services. Is the board of the view that we should nonetheless stay with a consistent notion across goods and services, or do you think we should? It's really coming back to Larry's question. It wasn't clear from your letter where you stand.
I think on balance, our preference would be to stick with a single model that is clearly the best solution. I think that what we were wrestling with and what we continue to wrestle with is what we've been wrestling around this table, which is control seems like a good starting point for that single model, and I agree with those who said that you should be looking at this from a sort of customer satisfaction point of view, because I don't really see how else you measure whether or not the supplier has performed other than by reference to customer satisfaction, unless you simply say, I've done £100 worth of work, it doesn't really matter whether it's any good or not, I've tried to perform something. So yes, we would like, on balance, we would like a single solution. We think that control is the most likely to lead to a workable way forward. But I say we're wrestling with these issues and the issues that I articulated, because the problem with all these discussions keep coming back to examples. And of course they come back to examples because it's the practical problems that we've all been wrestling with and we think are the problem. So to Tony's earlier example, clearly if I've driven my truck halfway across the US, it's quite easy to get to an idea that, well, I've probably performed half of my job. I sort of challenge whether or not driving halfway across America is actually worth half of the total fair value of transferring all the way across America, but that's possibly in the law. But then you come back to the audit, and Tony, sort of Andrew and I would probably haver around a bit, and probably so with Veronica, in terms of whether or not continuous transfer is right, because it is not as anywhere near as clear cut that you've driven halfway across America if Ernst & Young has done half an audit. And then, of course, you then back to Veronica's other point about, well, what might Ernst & Young or PwC be paid for half an audit, depending on the precise circumstances in which that audit relationship changed. And I'm sorry, I'm talking for far too long in answer to your question, but I'm trying to give you some sense of the discussions we have within the ASB on this issue.
We're done. You wanted to have the last word?
No, I've probably covered that in my report.
You got the last word anyhow. So thank you for these comments. Oh, Vago, one more.
I think up to now, I feel the most sonic question is how to determine the benefits of the customer, or as Robert said, you say satisfaction of the customer. If based on the efforts, it's easy. You know, half mile, or the others have already, you know, worked hard. But if you want based on the benefits, it is really, you know, difficult part.
So April, shall we with this? Please leave your mic on, Vega, otherwise we won't hear what you're thinking. April, take us forward.
Yes, okay. The second topic for today, which again was requested by a number of people, relates to identifying the separate performance obligations. Now, the guidance extracted from the ED, which we note on the agenda, is that the ED proposes that you should identify individual performance obligations accounted for separately on the basis of whether those promised goods or services underlying the obligation is distinct. And it goes on in the ED to give some guidance as to how you know when a performance obligation is distinct. And so we'd like to hear your views. Some of the points raised in comment letters relates to the level of guidance which is provided. Is that adequate to give a consistent determination of whether something's distinct? One concern, particularly in the construction area, is what level of segmentation and performance obligation should there be within the very complex contracts that you get in that area? And perhaps at the end, just as a point of detail, there have been some questions looking at performance obligations for the rights to use intangibles. What's the actual nature of that performance obligation, and is the guidance in the application useful for that? So I don't know if anyone would like to kick off for...
We allow 50 to 20 minutes for each topic now, so please be crisp, and I will break this off to some 15, 20 minutes. So
Andrew...
Thank you, Andrew Watchman. So to keep it crisp, welcome the board's efforts to introduce guidance in this area. We think it's an area where IAS 18 in particular is clearly deficient right now. So I think it's one of these areas where people can look at a particular contract and tend to have an intuitive sense of what ought to be separated, but trying to actually capture that to cover the whole panoply of arrangements using principle-based language is not easy, so it's kind of good luck. That's not a very helpful comment. Looking at what we've got in the ED in paragraph 23, I guess our concern is around 23B, which seems to want to collect things, separate things, which could in theory be delivered separately. We'd just like to, we don't pretend to have all the right words and any form of words need to be field tested, we'd just like to nudge that more in the direction of what would in practice be delivered separately, and that might encompass ideas such as business practice in particular sectors, the degree of interdependency between different deliverables, but to get away from this idea that in say a construction contract that every brick and plank of wood and steel girder could be a separable deliverable. So move it towards the practical and away from the theoretical.
Yes, I mean, as a general point, I mean, we genuinely don't understand what useful distinction there is between the segment of a contract and the performance obligation. We just find that very obscure and to tease out. As I say, there are about 15 of us, and none of us, frankly, can see that it performs any useful point. We think the key thing that's missing in identifying separate performance obligations, it's really looking for separate performance obligations, but I think you also have to look at whether there is interdependency between them, operational interdependency. Price interdependency was used quite usefully, I think, when looking at segmenting contracts upwards, certainly. We think operational interdependency is relevant when looking at performance obligations. And to take a quick example in construction, yes, you have design, yes, you have the foundations, yes, building them, yes, you have the shell and core, yes, you have the fit-out, but the fact is that they all interrelate. If the design isn't right, you're going to have to build it differently. If you encounter difficulties in construction, which may be not construction related, it may be just due to the weather pushing the program back, you're going to have to go back and redesign. And I think the way that your example is structured just doesn't capture that. You could well end up recognizing a lot of revenue, a lot of margin on the early activities in the contract, which when you go to the end of the contract, you make no or little profit, and we think that must be wrong for reasons we explained more fully in a schedule that we gave at one of the informal meetings. It also, we think, it just ignores the commercial basis of the contract with the customer. Again, look at the customer, and we might be accused of having our cake and eating it here, because we said the customer does get benefit from a half-finished hospital, but looking at it from the distant perspective, performance obligations, our obligation in building a hospital isn't to supply design and shell and core and fit out as a main contractor. It's to produce a finished hospital to a time and to a cost, so the customer doesn't have to worry about how it's done. The customer doesn't care where the air conditioning ducts are as long as they work, for instance. And we think that's something that's missing from there, basically. Those are our main points.
I think would echo some of Stuart's thoughts. Excuse me. We had a couple of overall thoughts around performance obligations. One is that we're not sure why it's necessary to segment contracts. If you separate contracts into performance obligations, and then the guidance for the extent to which you might true up the revenue recognised on delivered performance obligations when there's a change in consideration or whatever was very clear, then we're not sure that you would ever need to segment a contract, because you drive the revenue recognition off the performance obligations. And the second overarching point is that the guidance seems to be driven off starting with individual performance obligations and then seeing whether or not you could aggregate them and look at them together for the purposes of recognition. And we wondered if it might be better to come at it the other way and start with a contract and see what you should separate it into. Because with construction, for example, you could separate it into a lot of very, very small performance obligations if you started at the bottom. Whereas if you started at the top, then you might end up saying, well, the economic substance of this is not as many performance obligations as you might think. And so what we tried to do was think, well, is there a principle that gets towards that for identifying distinct performance obligations? Because we think the notion makes sense, that you would separate into distinct performance obligations. And we wondered whether something like a performance obligation is distinct if it's a discrete or a separate offering by the vendor or a separate purchasing decision by the customer. So maybe to take one of Stuart's examples, if the customer could and sometimes does buy design separately, you might say that's a distinct performance obligation. There might be other circumstances where you wouldn't, but then maybe some of the actual construction would never ever be offered separately or purchased separately. And so we wondered whether a principle like that, and I won't go through them in the interest of time, but we had three or four indicators that we thought might support that, that we jotted down in our letter.
I mean, I think if the customer could procure something separately, I mean, I don't think that's relevant if they don't, I suppose. That's my point. I mean, clearly, you're right. Clients can procure design separately and procure construction separately and perhaps procure a construction manager to manage the whole process with three different contracts. There are separate performance obligations, and it is relevant to split it. But where you have one lump sum turnkey contractor who supplies the whole thing, I don't think what might happen is relevant. And it would be about we own a professional services firm that designs buildings. But in a lump sum turnkey contract, that's not relevant.
I think a couple of points I want to ask. Stuart mentions about, if I understand you correctly, Stuart, you're mentioning about the contract management services, right? I think one thing I feel is that in the basis of conclusion, if I remember right, paragraph 56 through 59 of basis of conclusion, talked about contract management services and what do you need to do in those circumstances. Do you think that guidance should be brought forward because that leads you to believe that it is one performance obligation as opposed to multiple performance obligations? Is it the placing of that particular guidance that is giving the confusion about splitting it, or you think it's more than that?
I think it's more fundamental than that. Contract management obviously is an overall activity, but the other things that are relevant are just risk. The risk on one ostensibly separate performance obligation actually affects the other ones as well. That's the big issue for us. So it would be helpful, but I don't think it would be conclusive in itself, no.
Because in that situation, in the BC 56, the answer is that there's one performance obligation. You don't need to go down. So that's what I was asking.
Yeah.
The issue about segmenting and performance obligation has come up quite a bit, even in Norwalk. I wanted to understand mathematically what happens, because the model drives that if you have a separate performance obligations, if you allocate the purchase price among the purchase performance obligations on a relative fair value basis, and if there's any change, the model suggests to go back and reallocate it to all the performance obligations. In a segmenting, you don't do that. So mathematically, if you start from a point of allocating to various performance obligations, and any changes, you need to go back. But if you cut it down, I'm just trying to ask your guidance and your thoughts on that. If you break that mathematical equation down, what do you do? How do you do the further allocation? Do you focus only on that performance obligation, or how do you go back and allocate it? Because initially you allocated across all the performance obligations. What do you do?
I guess I'll answer since it was our point. I think our sense is that the adjustment to revenue recognized on a performance obligation that has already been satisfied should reflect the particular economics of a transaction. It shouldn't be automatic. And so I think our sense would be that in many cases, if you're done and you're satisfied, and the contingency is affecting something that is either being performed now or in the future, we wouldn't see that you would necessarily want to go back. And so we felt that if you get some robust guidance around the circumstances in which you might true up revenue that's already taken, together with the notion of a distinct performance obligation, then you wouldn't need to segment. Because you're right, the segmentation addresses exactly that point about truing up on previous performance obligations or not. And if there's clear guidance about when you might true up and the notion of a distinct performance obligation, we don't think you would need the segmentation guidance.
I'd like to echo quite a few points that Tony made. And we started very much in exactly the same place. You need to look at the contract as a whole to start with, and then ask yourself the question of whether you need to unbundle that contract. And if you're looking to unbundle, the first thing you need to answer is, are there any separate performance obligations that are involved? And the way we were viewing this was very much from the point of view whether it has a standalone value to the customer. By that, what we mean is whether the customer can actually use it in conjunction with some other goods and services. So back to that design service example, is it in principle a standalone service obligation? Well, yes, it could be identified as a standalone service obligation. But one shouldn't stop there. One then should ask the second question and say whether it makes sense to unbundle or whether you should be actually treating the contract as a whole. And here, echoing some of the points that Tony and Stuart were making, viewing the contract as a whole would make a lot of sense if the margin on the contract on all of those separate performance obligations that may be bundled together is actually consistent, if it is actually calculated together as one margin. However, if different performance obligations have distinct margins, I think that's when you are actually trying to unbundle, because that's where you're trying to say there is an information content in this piece of information that I want to separate. Otherwise, what is the point of separating if the whole thing is already there? So we would say put a focus on unbundling only to the extent that some stages are identified as having a significantly higher or a lower margin than the rest of the contract.
Yeah, Richard Martin, ACCA. We were also concerned that the complexity that this is being introduced by this segmentation and performance obligations, and we would like to see, you know, I think that only invoked when necessary. I think like Tony, we wondered, we thought the question of segmenting contracts, the first stage is a rather unnecessary one, and the first stage should only consider whether you ought to combine contracts, not whether you ought to segment them, so that in your sort of flow chart you might be able to cut out one or two boxes and arrows, and likewise when you get to the contract, I think I agree, I think we only want performance obligations separately identified where it's necessary, and I would agree with Veronica's indicator that one of the things we did take comfort from in the guidance you've already got is that if the performance obligations are performed much at the same time, then they probably don't need to be separated, and so we would definitely like that aspect retained. We wouldn't want to lose. That one.
Bertrand Perrin, Vivendi. I would like to comment on the last discussion point: the nature of performance obligations for licenses. We stressed in our comment letter the fact that we were wondering why using exclusivity as a criteria to determine the accounting treatments for such sales. So we perfectly understand the first step. It's a quite two-step approach, let's say. The first step, we perfectly understand it. If you sell the master copy of the intangible asset, then of course you will have to sell. Then, this perfectly mirrors when we are in the situation of the acquisition of such intangible assets. Those media assets, let's say, are intangible assets by nature, not necessarily accounted for as intangible assets in our balance sheets. Some of them might be working cap assets, and the only criteria to segment between intangible assets and working cap assets when we are in the situation of acquiring such licenses, rights, are based on do we get the master copy of the underlying assets or not, and that's the only criteria. Then exclusivity, of course we always buy such assets in getting some aspects some kind of exclusivity, but it's not the discriminant in terms of accounting in acquiring such assets. So of course we would like to keep a mirror accounting treatment for the sales, and the distinctions just only relying on whether we sell the master copy, then there is effectively a sale or not. There might be then the sale of the license, of a right to use this asset, but it won't be based on a distinction, exclusivity, non-exclusivity.
So this one, just to ask, so if you give someone the right to use, you license something for a period of time, do you think that transfers to the customer when you issue the license or over the license period?
Actually, what we do now, for instance, when we sign, when we could produce a film, for instance, and we sign with a pay television a licensing agreement, then we recognize a revenue of the sale of these licensing agreements when the film and television programs are available for telecast, and that perfectly mirror the fact that we generally account for the content asset when we acquire such broadcasting rights, when also we obtain from the studio, let's say, for in the case of the film, when we obtain the screening certificate from the studio.
So it's available for the customer to
exactly, book. Exactly, exactly.
So, nothing more on this topic?
The next topic, which people did ask to discuss and wasn't the subject of a specific question in the CED itself, relates to performance obligations when they're owners' performance obligations. The principle in the ED is that an entity should recognize a liability and a corresponding expense if a performance obligation is onerous. This point has been raised by a number of people in the comments letters. There is some concern, I think, that the onerous test should not be done at the performance obligation level, but at the contract level as a whole, for a variety of reasons. I don't know if anyone wanted to just tell the board what those reasons were.
Yes, Tony DeBell, I think, I guess our first point is we are probably not persuaded that we see onerous contract guidance in the revenue standard. Seems to be something that we would see somewhere else, perhaps in the liabilities standard, and I think we also have a concern overall that onerous contracts often seem to represent future operating costs rather than something that should be provided. But I think putting that overall view to one side, I think looking at them at the level of the performance obligation can lead to results that probably don't reflect the underlying economics. So if you look at something at the level of a performance obligation where a company sells a number of things in a bundled arrangement, they're distinct performance obligations, and you separate them, and it happens that there is a profit on one element but a loss on another, and that's just a commercial decision that a company has made, but it's going to end up supplying two things, one's profitable, one's not, but overall it's profitable. It doesn't seem to us to make sense to recognise a liability for what is a profitable contract. And so certainly we would say the test ought to be at the level of the contract. We might look at it higher than the contract and see what benefit the contract is bringing. And we thought of the example of an airline. An airline will sell a ticket to cover marginal cost. The guidance in the standard suggests that you might be looking at that performance obligation using a fully loaded cost, so allocating depreciation, fuel cost, staff cost, whatever, and you could end up with a perfectly rational decision to sell a spare seat to cover marginal cost. That becomes an onerous performance obligation, an onerous contract, because you're giving it a fully loaded cost, and again we wonder whether that's reflecting the economics of the business decision. And so I think this is probably the only area that we've suggested needs perhaps a more significant rethink.
Very strongly agree with that comment, in that we do believe that you need to look at this at a contract level, because fundamentally that's the way the transaction is done. It is done at the contract level, and things could be bundled, like Tony was articulating, things could be bundled together that may have very different margins, and some bits of it may well be done at a loss. But the whole point of entering into that contract, from the seller's point of view, is that they're actually entering into that contract in order to make a profit overall. So I think it would be totally inappropriate and not reflective of the economics of the transaction to suggest that entering into an overall profitable contract, a loss should be recognized. The seller is better off, not worse off, by doing the transaction.
Yeah, I mean, we would strongly support the general point that it's just inconsistent with the commercial substance of the transaction. I mean, it seems to us that this has really arisen almost as a drafting point by stealth, picking up from the previous points, in the sense that if you separate into separate performance obligations, clearly there's a presumption in standards that you don't net off revenues, costs, assets and liabilities, therefore you should have them separately. But the performance obligations side, without rehearsing all that, really looks at this from the entity's own position. If you turn it round and look at it again from the customer's position, if you have a contract with a customer that's overall profitable, but it's got two obligations, one of them is, one of them isn't, do you have an onerous customer? I mean, clearly not. A way out of it may be, Warren doesn't like rebuttable presumptions, but perhaps if you were to say that if you end up with a situation where you have an ostensibly onerous performance obligation in one contract, then perhaps you should reallocate the revenue among the other ones so as to eliminate the one that is onerous. That may be a way around it. That was only our own suggestion. But we just strongly disagree. It flies in the face of common sense. Nobody who isn't an accountant would think it makes any sense. And I can't see how any analysts would find it decision useful either.
Want to come in or no?
Yeah, well, I think the point has probably been made. I've just had it.
Okay.
We see the main reason to separate performance obligations is to recognise the right revenue at the right time and to extend that to this being the obligation being used to account for liabilities doesn't make sense to us.
That was easy and quick. Everyone agrees.
The next topic which a number of people talked about was allocating the transaction price over the performance obligations you've identified. And the ED proposes that you allocate that transaction price to all the separate obligations in proportion to the standalone selling price of the good or service which underlies each performance obligation. So it's done on a relative standalone selling price basis. This was brought up by a couple of people. There is the link with the contract segmentation proposals, how you allocate the discount, how you subsequently allocate any change in estimation of the transaction price. And some people did suggest alternatives to standalone selling price allocations. People were also concerned that when you're talking about allocating based on a standalone selling price, are you always going to be in a position where you can estimate that standalone selling price? That caused a number of people concerns. I know, for example, in the software industry, that was a difficulty. Anyone want to lean on that? Bertrand, I don't know if you wanted to mention the difficulty that gives you.
Actually, we would like to get more precisions on what the board means by standalone selling price. I mean, we have no problem with the segmentation principle in terms of recognition principle. We have no problem in the allocation principle, in the way to allocate revenue between various segments and between various performance obligations. We think that our current accounting treatments would be consistent with the provisions contained in the ED. Our concern is more on the measurements, that is to say, on the exact proportion of revenue to allocate to which segment, actually. And so today, in the telecom sectors, you all know that we generally sell an handset that is subsidized by the telecom operator, and then in addition to this handset, we also sell a subscription agreement. So the point there is how to allocate the, let's say, discounts on the handset. Today what we are currently doing is allocate at the sale of the handset 100% of these discounts to the sale of goods, so to the sale of the handset. Based on the future provisions, we understand that a portion of these discounts might be allocated to the subscription agreements. So just a couple of comments. First thing, as we mentioned earlier, for construction companies, the contractor role is profitable, of course. That's the first comment. Then, standalone selling price in itself is not sufficient. Let's take the example, for instance, of our operation in France. We have tried to get data to estimate the proportion of sales that were performed unbundled. That is to say, a standalone sale of a handset or a standalone sale of a subscription agreement. In terms of value of our sales, those represent less than 5% of the sales. So why a standalone selling price of either a subscription agreement or an handset based on such low value or such low sales would be representative of the value of the handset subsidized and the subscription agreement in a bundled offer? So what we are questioning there is we would like to keep, let's say, the current measurement principle that is contained for us in IFRIC 13, which is a fair value measurement principle, and a fair value that is relative in terms of an incremental value, let's say. We strongly support that view. That is the first thing. And the second thing is, if it's no longer the case, then what do you exactly mean by standalone selling price? Because we consider that we have no relevant observable price today, so we would need to estimate those standalone selling prices, and we would like to get more inputs so as to be able to properly estimate those standalone selling prices, and above all, that everybody estimates it the same way. Because what is also something that is really critical for us is comparability. Today, under current accounting principles, all telecommunication operators in Europe, and not only in Europe, so in Northern America, Canada, and America, and also Japan, we are all applying the same accounting treatments. And we fear that there might be in the future discrepancies due to a lack of guidance on this standalone selling price concept.
This is something, you know, that we are aware of, and we have obviously discussed with the telco people. It's difficult, really, under the model, because if, for example, you're selling an iPhone and you're giving an iPhone to someone very cheaply or for free, it is obvious that something of value is transferred to that customer. And, you know, under the model, we'd like to see that depiction being represented. Similarly, it's quite easy. Well, it would seem to be quite easy to actually establish what a standalone selling price of the handset would be, and I can't help feeling personally, I mean, this hasn't been discussed by the board, that in some way when you're pricing that contract, you must sort of have some matrix in your mind with salesmen to say that, you know, if you have a 2-year contract for the service, then you'll give them a free iPhone. If they have a 6-month contract for service, then they get the little phone that just receives text or what have you. So I'm not sure if you really haven't got some sort of guidance as to what the standalone selling price would be and what your inherent discount is to make sure that you're recovering that, so that there is a relationship, I think, between the length of the contract and the price of the service contract compared with the sort of gift or incentive that you give people at the start of it.
In my previous comments, there was two things. The first thing is really in the measurement principle, to understand why we have derived from relative fair value to standalone selling price. That would be the first thing, the first question to answer, I would say, in a future accounting standard. And the second thing, so we just April, we do not give an iPhone for free generally. The customer pays some amount of money, even though if the handset is heavily subsidized. The point would be then probably not to consider, because the there's also a practical question at the end. We have numerous couples, let's say, a specific type of handset and a specific type of subscription agreements. And I think another European telco company has said previously when we had previous round table all together that they had more than 1,000 of them. So obviously there is we have also a practical concern at the end of it. So at the minimum, what we would like is to work together to see how we could manage this practicability. Probably, what we see is okay. Let's talk about smartphones, for instance. Let's consider smartphones as a whole, because if we are from the perspective of the customer, what the customer receives is in every instance the functionality of an iPhone. Technically, today they are quite close from one another. Then, obviously, the difference would be ultimately with some for some of them the marketing or the brand. Of course, we are not selling a brand. We are really selling an access to our network and so a functionality to our customer and let's say a group of handsets, smartphone, for instance. Would provide similar functionality.
Tony? Yeah, our sense is to, I think, probably reflect some of what April said, that it's important to reflect the substance of the arrangement and to get the discount allocated properly between the different components of the transaction. And we wonder whether using a principle that's based on IFRIC 13 or the residual will always get to that answer if you end up either breaking even, perhaps losing money on the initial transaction, and then there is a higher margin going forward. So our overall perspective is that the accounting should reflect the economic substance of what's happened, and we think that in a majority of cases that's going to be the case by using relative standalone selling price. Where we might suggest there was a little bit more help for folks is to suggest that there are a variety of ways that you might be able to estimate the standalone selling price. So using that as a principle, but there are a variety of ways you might be able to do that, and we had some thoughts in our letter. And secondly, to recognise the concern that Bernard had, that it will be good to say this isn't something that has to be done on a contract-by-contract-by-contract basis, that it's something you could look at across a portfolio of contracts that are similar so that the application of it is going to be practical.
Just to... How would you define standalone selling price? What do you consider as being a standalone selling price in that specific instance?
I think we would look at the standalone selling price as being the price for which that item would be sold, could be sold, is sold. But I say there's not necessarily one way of coming at it, because if you as an organisation do sell, use the handset example, separately, then that would be a starting point. I agree there'll be a range of different prices and different packages, so you'll need to... consider the economics of a particular group of transactions, but if you do sell it separately, that to me would be a starting point.
Yeah, but it would be you would consider it as a market price then? Because obviously for some I would be more specific on that. For some smartphones you have a value of the smartphones, catalog value of the smartphone, that is let's suppose 550 euros, for instance. But in France, nobody buys such an iPhone for this price. Nobody, there is a market price that is not this price. And the price is a market price, contractually fixed between the parties, and that will be accessible to the customer.
I certainly wouldn't say list price.
So the fact that it's published in a catalogue wouldn't drive it. I said that the price at which it changes hands, I might start by saying, what did you pay for it?
Okay.
As an indication
so
of
the cost plus margin approach.
Something like that might be appropriate. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer. There are a number of ways that you might go about estimating.
We could consider that, but as you mentioned, if we are not separating it on a contract by contract basis, otherwise it would be just a nightmare. Still.
We viewed that as very much the way April articulated the issue earlier, which is in some cases you are looking at having to allocate the discount because it's difficult to allocate the discount that is embedded in the transaction to the two separate obligations, say, bundled together. And we see the default approach as described in the standard one, or we see it as a default approach very much, saying that you go to the standalone selling price, is the right way and would produce the right answer in most cases. We do recognize some of the practical difficulties, the ones that the Tran was referring to, like could you potentially do this on a portfolio basis in some cases? What are the practical expedients? And I think some help would be very useful there. However, we do not stop there, if you wish. We basically believe that in some cases the default approach does not work. And we have given an example in our letter of the software licenses, where what you actually have is a transaction that very much bundles together two deliverables, the deliverables that contain very different margins. And where you have got those very different margins embedded in the transaction, we don't think the selling price, standalone selling price, does give me the right way of allocating the discount. So what we would be seeking to find is a bit more flexibility, something that pushes you back to the principle of trying to reflect the underlying economics of the transaction. And we would say that start with the default approach, define the parameters when you can depart from that. For example, different margins, very high margin combined with a very low margin type of transaction. So that would be one scenario where we would say that is the parameter for departure. And then you can depart to a couple of alternative methods that we believe you should articulate the alternative methods. For example, one based on the margin, so allocate pro rata to the margin embedded in the different bits of the transaction, or in some cases, the residual approach. And that is something that we believe would address most of the issues that we have seen in practice and would get you to the situation where you would come up with an answer you really want to get to, reflecting that there was a delivery with the first bit of the transaction and something needs to be reflected in respect of that, yet without trying to pretend that the transaction contains that sort of smoothing approach effectively as in respect of the discount.
I think just on the relative margin, I think in a sense, I suppose we would start from the point that, in terms of what's in the basis of conclusion, the logic seems to be that you potentially use relative margin as actually your starting point rather than relative selling price. Obviously, if in many cases it won't actually matter if you have produced equivalent margins that you may not actually get to a significantly different answer. But I suppose I agree with Veronica in terms of having that open as an option. The only challenge is really how you provide the guidance and which way and which has the most emphasis within the guidance. Ultimately, what I think we all agree on is whatever you end up with should not end up with a silly margin then coming out in the final answer. And to me, that's the guidance has to get us to a situation where we don't do that.
Or just to answer to Veronica, we are also concerned by software accounting because we have a games division that sells multiple elements arrangement. So that is a box software and an online service. And as for now, based on the current provisions that are mainly derived from US GAAP, we have no VSOE for neither the box software nor the online service. So what we do is we just defer the wood price of the box over an estimated over the estimated service period. So basically, what it leads to, just to give an example, we gave that example in our comment letter. We launched a video game last year. We sold 20 million copies worldwide of this game last year. It was really a hit. And most of the sales, because the game was launched end of November, most of the sales were done just before Christmas in December. And we accounted for nearly no revenue in 2009, whereas nearly half of the sales were done in 2009. So we think we really need to change that to because here we have a problem. We do not reflect anymore the economics of the transaction, and we think that effectively the provisions that might be precise, of course, no problem with that, but the provisions contained currently in the ED would totally fit this goal, that is to say we would be able to estimate a portion of revenue to allocate to the box software and a portion of revenue to allocate to the online service agreements.
Wanted to ask two questions, one to Veronica and one to Tony. So let me start with Veronica. Just understanding, I appreciate the point that you're raising. It should not be only standalone selling prices, but margin too. So there is some appeal to that. But I want to understand how residual method, which by definition will allocate the discount all to the performed portion of it rather than to unperform. How do we reconcile that with the principle that the discount should be along the entire transaction? Because residual method is a very conservative method, as you know, Veronica, that it is only to push all the discount up front, but that's not the economics of the transaction in that sense. And so how do you reconcile that? Can you help me with that? Because
I think you just said the very important piece at the end. You said it does not the economics of the transaction. And I think where I would always start with the try and reflect the economics of the transactions. And I think in many cases, your default approach of the selling price allocation is actually the right way to decide what the economics of the transactions actually represent and would get you to the right answer. It is only when you've got those very different margins involved and you're trying to allocate the discount that you would depart. So for me, it is very important to start with the right parameter for departure. Now, having decided that I'm definitely needing to depart from the default methodology, I'm going into the what do I depart to? And I think that's, again, an important piece. You have to depart to something that would reflect the economics of the transaction. And I cannot say that I have, you know, considered every example that may come up for which between the selling price and the just looking at the margin and doing prorata to the margin embedded in the transaction type of allocation exercise, that I would have ruled out all the possible economics of the transactions. And what I would say, if the economics of the transactions point to the residual method being the right method, well, that's the right method. Otherwise, I start pretty much selling price doesn't work. What are the economics of the transaction? If the economics say best work of the margins, work of the pro rata margin approach, and if it doesn't work, in that case, you're basically saying, does the residual value methodology help them? Or residual method, rather.
Yeah, I'm curious because all the residual methods that I know of came because of preventing the abuse in the revenue recognition as opposed to economics,
yeah.
Like the software industry,
yeah.
And the entire US GAAP is written only to prevent deferring discounts to a later stage and making the revenue upfront to be as zero as possible. So I'm maybe we can talk separately offline because I'm failing to see where the economics will capture, but maybe you have an example I can be educated on.
Haven't got the ready example,
yeah.
But I wouldn't want to rule it out as never reflecting the possible economics of the transaction. That's why I think the overriding principle has to reflect the economics of the transaction.
Thank you. Tony, just to understand, you did say that sometimes you have to do it on a portfolio basis.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just, I thought maybe you reacted to what our friend from Vivendi said about the iPhones and all that. Is that the situation you're talking about, portfolio, and how does it differ?
I think when we talk about portfolio, that we recognize if there are a significant number of different arrangements that are perhaps broadly similar, that it could be impractical to do the allocation on a contract-by-contract basis. So if we've used the example of a telco that has a significant number of different packages, it might not be our sense is it might not be practical to be looking at every single contract with a customer if it's possible that every single contract might be very slightly different. But it might be possible to look at the economics across a portfolio of similar contracts and say, okay, the way we're going to estimate the standalone selling price across this portfolio is to do it this way. And so that we think would be able to reflect the underlying economics without putting an extreme burden on folks to look at each individual contract.
But in that situation, you're thinking the portfolio should all the performance obligations in that portfolio happen at or near the same time.
Yes. So if you're separating a handset and the airtime, you'd say, well, okay, there is a mechanism for separating the total price, but that you will be taking the revenue on the handset when the handset is delivered and airtime
over it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Sid?
Yes, I've got a question for Bertrand. You don't seem to like LED when it comes to the smartphones, but do like it when it comes to the software. One of the reasons you gave for not liking the smartphones was concerns over comparability, which sort of relates to what PK is talking about. Don't you have similar concerns about comparability in terms of the software and that allocation you were just talking about for your game?
Sure. So any guidance on the way to estimate standalone selling price, which is a notion we are quite not always understanding, would be very helpful for our software activity and for our telecom activities.
So if you produced
Stephen, I was just saying that from where we're coming from in terms of accounting treatments in the video game sector, the provisions of the ED is for sure an improvement. I mean, there is strictly no our current accounting treatments are still disconnected from the economics of the transaction today because of this VSOE notion. So basing something on estimates would be an improvement. Then, of course, we need to work out just to make sure that those estimates would be ultimately comparable.
I don't really see the difference between the phone and a service and a game and a service.
Yes, but I don't get then exactly your question.
But you seem to want a different accounting treatment for supplying a phone and providing. Oh, you don't?
No. The main difference is that we don't subsidize anything in the video game industry, whereby we subsidize the purchase of the handset by the customer in the telecom sector. That is the main difference.
Really, the concern is the
concern on the telecommunications activity by comparison to the video game is on the discounts and the allocation of the discounts on the across the contract.
Okay. Good.
Okay. The last two points on the agenda, perhaps the region could cover them relatively quickly just so that everyone at the end has a chance to talk about their individual concerns. The first of those is credit risk. Now, the ED proposes that in determining the transaction price, an entity should reduce the amount of the promised consideration to reflect the customer's credit risk. And so revenue would be recognized at the probability-weighted amount of the consideration that the entity expects to receive. This has come up in a few comments. Three sort of aspects, I think, perhaps. A number of people think it's conceptually very understandable and desirable, but from a practical point of view, they might have issues. Some people are concerned at adjusting revenue to reflect the credit risk of the customers. Some people are concerned that users actually find the gross amount of the revenue useful information. And so I don't know if any of you have comments on any of those aspects.
Well, our concern is the latter one, which is basically there is a lot of useful information embedded in the gross revenue number. There is also a lot of useful information embedded in the bad debt number, and particularly the trends of what the bad debts are doing all the time and what is the gross revenue doing all the time. And our concern would be about the loss of that information. But as you say, conceptually one can see why you end up where you end up, but we wouldn't want to have the two numbers netted in the revenue line.
We would agree that the gross number and the bad debt number are important, but we think that can be addressed through disclosure, and we believe that the amount of revenue you book has to correspond with the initial recognition amount of the receivable, which might change depending on where you go with expected loss models and that sort of thing. But we think there has to be consistency and not a gap between those two requirements. I think the other issue is, though, what you do with the remeasurement. And, if you actually do collect 100 cents in the dollar, do you actually take that through the revenue line? Our letter ultimately didn't support that. You've got to account for credit adjustments under the financial instrument standard, but there was quite a lively debate in getting to that view.
I think our view was that the gross revenue number isn't particularly decision useful if you're not actually going to get all of it. We thought it's quite legitimate that customer specific risk that's actually reflected, for instance, where you charge one customer a different price to another one for the same thing, we think it is legitimate to adjust for that. For instance, because your customer has known liquidity problems or they're in a geographically difficult part of the world. But we don't see how decision useful it is, and it would certainly be very costly, for instance, to recognise a different amount of revenue for one customer who was a single A credit and a different revenue for another one who was a double A credit, because the expected probability of default is different. We just think that's disproportionate. So we think it should be really specific customer related, would be useful and would be cost effective.
Richard Martin, ACCA. Yes, I think we would very much agree with that. And in fact, in some of the round tables in some of the outreach events that you've done, it seems like you were trying to, you know, there were attempts to try and get across the bold presumption that of every revenue you would be deducting some element for credit risk was not what was intended. So I think we do need some clarity here. I would have thought where in some way the revenue has reflected, has an inbuilt specific credit risk element in it, then that's fair enough. It's a bit like it is obviously a bit like the time value of money element, which is, I think, perhaps less controversial, because I think people know that where the time value of money is not going to be material, because the receivable is going to be collected fairly quickly, and that there isn't a sort of financing element to the transaction, then that's fair enough. And so what I think we want is something fairly comparable on the credit risk, so that we are not taking off some slice of revenue for each contract for some expected loss. But I think it does you will need clarity between what you're going to say on financial instruments and what you're going to say here. On the whole, we would quite like a trade receivable to be clearly rather scoped out of what you're saying on financial instruments, because I think that it doesn't always, what you're trying to do with other sorts of financial instruments don't particularly work very well with trade receivables.
I think we are very supportive of the board's proposals on this. I mean, I understand the practical concerns, but I think in principle it's very difficult to argue that you shouldn't be reflecting customer credit in the recognition of revenue, initial recognition of revenue. To me, frankly, after that, everything comes down to a question of materiality, just as it does on time value of money. And preparers will have to consider that in the light of the guidance. But I think in terms of coming from first principles, it's very difficult. But not difficult. We would agree entirely with the board's principles, and certainly we see that as being consistent with our own standards in the UK.
Very hard to disagree with what Robert says from a conceptual perspective. I think it is consistent with the overarching principles to make an adjustment for credit risk. I think we would say two or three things. One is everything we've heard from users suggests they find the gross information useful. And we wonder whether doing something that is conceptually pure, if it's not delivering what the users of the financial statements would like to see, I just wonder whether or not that's the way to go. We've also heard that at some level it might place an additional burden on systems for perhaps relatively little additional result. Now, we agree obviously that materiality might come into play there, but that, you know, in theory you will be reducing revenue for almost every transaction, and we wonder whether that's just a step too far in terms of practicality. And I think finally, if the impact is significant, so for example, if a business makes a habit of selling into a subprime market because there's no significant cost of sales or whatever, does it make sense that the subsequent catch-up adjustment doesn't go on the revenue line to the extent that there is a significant difference? So I think conceptually, very hard to disagree with it. We just wonder if there are some practical issues around whether users will find it helpful and how easy it will be to implement.
Okay. Very good.
Very simple questions, Monica and Tony. Now, if follow what you said, you know, provide gross amounts at the top, and then the bad debt part, do you think it should be presented as a deduction of the revenue, or traditionally some companies present it as part of the general expenses? Which one is much more useful?
Provided it is clearly identified, information is in the primary statement, it's on the face of the P&L. I think that's what we would be seeking. It doesn't matter whether it goes against the revenue line, i.e. at the top bit, whether it is somewhere else, but provided I can see the gross revenue and I can see the bad debt number. And I think we're being quite consistent in our commentary, because we do see credit risk information as a very important information. We agreed with your proposals on how you treat credit and the measurement of the liabilities in the financial world. And we do believe that credit risk has very important piece of information to the user. That's why we would like to see it separately identified. Geography, whereabouts, is not a big concern to us.
I'd say much the same thing.
Thank you for that. April?
Next topic is disclosure. Now, the boards have given an objective in the exposure draft that disclosure should help users understand the amount, the timing, risks and uncertainty of revenue and cash flows arising from a contract with customer. In the exposure draft, we specifically asked for the usefulness of the different aspects of the proposed disclosure requirements. The boards are obviously interested in the cost benefits of the proposed disclosure requirements. We've had some comments from people, comment letters in the room. Some people feel that the disclosures might be onerous on preparers. Some people are concerned that some aspects of the disclosures relate to forward-looking sort of aspects of accounting for a contract. So any particular comments on disclosure which you'd like to raise with the board?
We support many of them, but we feel some of them are just, first of all, they're over prescriptive. And for instance, paragraph 75 and 76, the contract balance reconciliation. I mean, from our own perspective, it's not information that we use in our business. And from the perspective of users, we've never had a user ask us for this information. And there is always a danger if you ask people what they want, you'll get a long wish list. But I mean, the test for us is whether we get asked for it. And picking up that point, I mean, the boards have and suggested that you disclose the forward performance obligations. That is decision useful information, certainly in our industry, long-term contracting. And in fact, we already give this information, but in information to the analysts, not as part of the gap measures. And in fact, as far as that is concerned, for our industry, we would find it more difficult to comply with that prescription, eliminating contracts of more than a year. It's simpler and easier and more useful to give it for all that information. So what I'm saying, I suppose, is that we think they're overly prescriptive, and you should perhaps just stick more to the principles, and obviously require people to explain the basis of any non-GAAP numbers that they use. A discussion of performance obligations, including onerous ones, for instance. I mean, with the best will in the world, I think you're going to get a lot of boilerplate about onerous performance obligations, and we'd certainly struggle without rehashing the previous point to explain to people how we have an onerous performance obligation in a profitable contract, and, you know, welcome some guidance on what we might say.
Thank you, Andrew Watchman. Well, we do welcome the flexible approach on level of detail and also the exhortation to avoid duplication, so we'd commend that. I share the concerns about the contract balance reconciliation. We just struggle to see what useful information content that actually comprises. On the, what I'll call the backlog disclosure, paragraph 78, 2 points really. First of all, we think that by including a one-year cut-off for that, that rather undermines its potential usefulness. Just my video, take an all-or-nothing approach to that, but overall we believe nonetheless that's better information better provided in the management commentary because of its forward-looking nature.
Yes, I mean, again, on the one-year point, I mean, IFRS is only applies unless other entities choose to apply it to large entities. And, you know, we'd be surprised if large entities know what performance obligations that they have going forwards for all contracts, if only to make the going concern disclosure and just estimate their own liquidity. We don't honestly think there's a huge amount of extra cost there. But other industries may disappear.
I think our concerns over the disclosures are about the segregation of the different sorts of revenue, and the integration of these requirements here with IFRS 8, a standard that we've had relatively recently. There isn't any sort of withdrawal of IFRS 8involved here. You've just simply added another dimension into which revenue and various other things that go with that would have to be provided. I think this degree of analysis is very important. The granularity of the disclosures is obviously a multiplication factor when it comes to each of them, the other lines that you tend to require. So that we're requiring more analysis of each item, and then you've got a whole lot of items. It does tend to multiply up the disclosures required, and we're not sure that's very helpful. So I think we would see that probably the segmentation of the revenue should probably follow follow the principles of IFRS 8, and the segmentation shouldn't be taken much below that level. Like others, we thought the movement of the performance of obligations and contract balance isn't a very helpful item as well. We do note that on these disclosures you are tending to put in something at the beginning which is trying to encourage people to simply stick to the materiality of the item and provide suitable information that goes with those goes with your overall principles, but But I think then there is then a list, and disclosure is commonly done on the basis of a checklist, and so that if you put the items, if you put the items in, people are going to generally supply them rather than take the decision to eliminate them. So each of the specifications that you're providing beyond the overall principles, I think you've got to expect that will be regarded as an item that people have got to put in, whatever you say in your paragraph number 70 and so on. So I think it will be a significant increase in disclosure you're mandating here.
Very good. So let's leave disclosures with that. What other topics would you like to bring up?
Could I just say thank you? That's been really useful for me. All wanted to have on the agenda. Very useful feedback. I think, as Jan said, it would just be useful now if each of the 10 participants had a minute or two to just give us your closing comments and any general observations you have.
Before we do that, just in case anyone has a specific topic, and I include board members into that. Larry, for example.
Yeah.
And particularly.
Yeah. One topic that wasn't on the agenda, but we talked about a little bit in Norwalk, was the topic of variable compensation or contingent consideration. And many of the people at the roundtables in Norwalk were against the provisions in the ED, and there were two primary reasons. One is where you have binary type of contingent consideration, so it's either all or nothing. They felt that a probability weighted calculation would give you a number that just could not exist under the contract. It's either all or nothing, not this probability weighted number. And so that was one objection to it. And the second objection was probably cultural. From a U.S. perspective, people are just against probability-weighted calculations because they feel that that means you have to get out your Excel spreadsheet and have 10,000 different variations of what the variable compensation may be, which board members indicated that they did not believe that that's the way you need to do it, but yet people in America think that that's how you need to do it. So I'm just, and therefore, I think a lot of the people around the table said they'd rather use a best estimate. Not very many people were able to define what they meant by best estimate very well, but in their mind, they know what it is. So I just throw that out, and I'm curious as to your reaction.
Happy to give a reaction. We would say much the same thing. Just not sure it's helpful if you're going to get either 0 or 100 to have 60 on the books. I think you'd be better off to have 0 or 100 together with an explanation that there's a risk that the outcome might be different. I think our sense would be that there should be some flexibility for management to be able to determine what's the most appropriate way to make an estimate in a given situation. And in some cases it may well be weighted average probability if you've got a portfolio with a range of possible outcomes, but there'll be other circumstances where it might make more sense to go with best estimate. I understand that best estimate to me might mean something different best estimate to you, but that management should have some flexibility in how they do it.
Yeah, probability weighted, and I think it's most appropriate where it isn't, where it is either not a binary outcome, or it isn't driven by a larger population of possibilities. So if you had a series of contracts with binary outcomes, you could do a probability weighted estimation. I think that would be that would probably be the right answer. But where you have single or small populations with binary outcomes, you probably need the most likely outcome on each of them, and not get into the probabilities.
Bertrand?
It was more a very short comments on application.
Okay, let's stick to this question if anyone else has a comment on that.
Yes, I very much agree with the comments that you had in Norwalk. It's in our letter, too. I don't think that's just cultural. We do think that there is a huge difference between large populations, homogenous items, where probability weighted approach makes sense, but elsewhere, where you're looking at binary outcomes, and in the revenue recognition territory, you're looking at things like success fees. Which are quite common, where it is a binary outcome. We don't believe that's right.
Anything else on this topic? Various questions?
Well, just to support the proposal in this area, we think that if you've got a 60% chance of petting 100, then 60 is the right number and has more information content than either 0 or 100.
Steve, on this topic?
Yeah.
Going to say the same thing, which is
I was going to ask Veronica and Tony, how big is a portfolio? How many items do you need before you switch from best estimate to the probability weighting?
Somebody referred to a rhinoceros. You know when probability weighting works, you know when it doesn't.
So we have the rhinoceros clause in the same
Yeah. I think maybe there's a challenge for Kenny and Henry to get the word rhinoceros into the standard. I guess I don't think there's a one size fits all. I don't see there's a bright line. I would just say that management should have the flexibility to make the estimate in the way that they think best reflects the transaction that they're dealing with. And I guess I do have a slightly different view to Andrew or to you or to Warren, which is I'm not sure that putting a number that you know will not be the outcome in the books is more helpful than having one of the potential outcomes together with some disclosure about the uncertainty.
What's the principle, Tony, that's driving management's decision?
I think providing information is going to be helpful to the users.
That really doesn't help me, I must admit. I've got to make a decision at the end of the day what the number is.
Could I just come back on that point? Warren, I think it's kind of important to sort of in the revenue recognition world, from my point of view, what's important to me is that if I actually said, okay, well, there is a 70% chance that I'll earn this extra 100 and therefore that 70 will be recognized under the weighted probability approach. So I've now accelerated revenue recognition for the 70. That is not the 70 I will ever have. I will only have 100 if I actually deliver. Now, it's never going to get to that 70 or 79 or 99. It'll only be 100. And I don't want to accelerate revenue recognition. I actually, for once, want to be prudent. And particularly in that revenue recognition area, when I talk about binary outcomes, I do worry about starting to bring in numbers that is just
a
mathematical calculation.
In the context of liability recognition,
we do not support in the liability recognition proposals that you had earlier in the year that same approach, which is absolutely we're absolutely consistent. We do it in the same way.
Zero, so you're happy to put zero.
Okay.
With the disclosure.
Two or three points I want to make here. We had a very healthy discussion on this in Norwalk, and I don't want to rehash that, but I think deep inside what Tony said and Veronica said, I just wanted to tease it out a little bit and understand, are you concerned, because most of the situations are binary in the contingency fee. There are continuous payments, but let's say most of them are binary. Are you concerned, when you say reasonably estimable, are you concerned with that language? You are looking for more certainty, because when you book either 0 or 100, you are basically saying that, hey, my reasonable estimate is really what it really translates to it. I'm not certain to get it. Then only I'll book 100. Is that what you're trying to look at it? Because the moment you say it's reasonably estimable, and then you need to think about in a probabilistic manner. If you think it's virtually certain one way or the other, then 0 or 100 makes sense. But the moment you drop it down to reasonably estimable, I think
the probability comes into picture. But I want to ask another point before you react, is that as auditors, there are four, if I counted correctly last time, in this room right now, how would you even document that? How would you even put it in your papers other than stapling the videotape of the person who said that this is reasonably estimable? How do you even audit that?
That's too technical.
Well, it isn't actually, because we didn't suggest reasonably estimable. We didn't actually suggest some sort of solution to this, because we don't see an obvious solution other than actually saying for binary outcomes, you put one of the real outcomes that is going to happen, and you may go with virtually certain, don't know, that may be the answer. We've not actually recommended a solution. We debated that at some length, and we haven't got a perfect answer to this one, because I don't think there is one. I don't think there is a perfect answer to this situation, and I think you will end up with a pragmatic solution. In the revenue recognition world, we want to be prudent, probably, when it comes to this.
That's what I want to drive.
That's what you get on this topic. We have Philip sitting here patiently waiting to tell us about his business.
Yeah, Philip Holmes, Cooperatives UK. Thanks for the opportunity of actually participating at the round table. Every so often there are drafts that the ISB come up with that don't have the intention of actually disadvantaging certain sectors of the business community. Unfortunately, in this case, this is one particular standard that does. We don't believe that there was any intention to do that. However, the reality is, and if our advisors are to be believed on this, and our advisors are KPMG, then this draft exactly does that. Now, the issue that I want to raise is the considerations payable to the customer. Now, by applying them in the strict sense of this standard, a co-op dividend could be regarded as a refund of some of the considerations to the customer. And a refund should be recognised. Why? Purely because the share of a dividend paid to each member is related to the level of purchases. The link between purchases and the dividends, purely a mechanism, reflecting the nature of a cooperative rather than the conventional investor model. Now, in the standard investor model, the entity bases its dividend on the number of shares in accordance with that particular organisation. In a cooperative, we divide our dividend up based on the amount of trade that we have with the society over the years. So by applying these paragraphs in this exposure draft, it could be argued that a cooperative dividend should be regarded as a refund, and a refund liability should be recognised. Now, we can test that, or we at least seek clarity. Why? Well, there's an inconsistency between the draft and IAS 10. At the moment, a cooperative, to be a member of a cooperative, you pay a capital contribution to become a member. This amount is credited to share capital and regarded as equity. And some of you will remember the debates that we had a number of years ago were equity in a cooperative was attempted to be reclassed as liability. Fortunately, that was resolved by IFRIC 2. Now, when a cooperative pays a dividend to a member, it's essentially paying a dividend to an equity shareholder. And it must be recognised, or should I say, it mustn't be recognised as a liability as stated in IAS 10.12. Now, this standard directly opposes that, so there's an inconsistency there. There's also the PLC argument. At the moment, the PLC recognises its dividend as a distribution. Now, by applying this, we would have to actually deduct from revenue. I mean, that leads to an unfair disadvantage and not a level playing field.
Could I just say, Philip, just perhaps for the benefit of people not from the UK, that cooperatives are a well-known way of doing business in the UK historically. And the societies whereby customers are given a membership number every time they go along to buy something from the shop or the business, they're given credit for that. And at the end of the accounting period, they're each given a rebate based on how much they've spent. And under the terms of the model, a payment made to a customer would be treated as a rebate and deduct it from the revenue, or it could be treated as a sort of returns provision, as Philip suggests. So that's the distinction that we're making here, is that payments back to your members, which PLCs are treated as dividends, would be interpreted under the standard as being a reduction of the revenue and netted off in that way, which
that's
is
right.
your basic problem.
We don't recognise it as a discount. I mean, basically, the payment of a cooperative dividend, it's a payment to a member or an equity shareholder who just happens to be a customer. It's just a mechanism of how it's done. So we think that one of the suggestions is that there should be specific exclusions regarding the ownership relationship. We also believe that the exposure draft in its current form could put cooperatives in conflict with their own legal constitution if it requires member dividends to be deducted from revenue rather now than as a distribution of profits. And finally, what I would say is that the main reason for this exposure draft was to improve comparability between across organisations and entities of the revenue recognition practices. We don't feel that that applies in the cooperative context. A lot of our European and international colleagues are watching this with great interest, because there are different interpretations that are actually being put on this, but we have to be led by our advisers. And our advisers are saying, and if your auditors actually do say this, is that is how it will actually be applied, then it will apply not just to the UK but internationally.
And that's a change from what you have today?
Absolutely.
Does the rebate relate to the volume of purchases during the year or your equity volume?
Well, by that, it's a return on equity. Because a cooperative member is a shareholder who also happens to be a customer, in America, they actually call it a patronage rebate. Some people, the way this would be applied is like a discount. I mean, we would refute that. It's a distribution. And as such, it shouldn't be netted off revenue.
But Philippe, but if Larry was a... Larry and I are both members of your cooperative.
Yeah.
Larry really likes your products and he buys a lot of them. I don't.
Yeah.
Will we get different dividends?
Yes, you would. Yes.
That's the answer to his question then. It's
okay.
Driven by volume.
Now, can I ask a slight difference? Maybe it is not appropriate, but I would like to ask. From the income tax point of view, how they account for such dividends?
Well, I mean, the income tax...
Personal income tax.
Regarding the recipient of it?
Yes, yes. As investment income?
I am not sure how an actual individual would put that on his actual income tax.
That's our side of this meeting we have here. Sorry to interrupt.
It's issue, and I wouldn't want to actually bring taxation into that.
Could I just ask a question? How does being a member of a cooperative differ, say, from being a card member of a cash and carry type shopping facility where you're given a card and every time you go to the cash and carry you spend more money and you get a rebate there based on that?
Well, I think you're actually getting the rebate there and then it's actually discounted prices. I mean, what happens here is you actually pay whatever the selling price is of that product. Each individual corporate society at the end of its trading period would then assess how much it actually wanted to distribute. It wouldn't just distribute to its shareholders, it would distribute to the community. So in essence, what this does, it actually splits up that part of the dividend would still be classed as a distribution, but the other part that actually goes back to its customers would be netted off revenue.
So, Philip, your question is noted, and we will consider it, of course, and we'll somehow treat it. And
thank you.
I'll allow one more question if it's a short one.
Very short one. On application of any future provisions on review, we perfectly understand why retrospective application gives a correct theoretical answer, but in practice it will just be in this matters, in this specific matter, it would be a nightmare to implement. So, if you decide on retrospective application, you should be aware of the fact that really it will be a nightmare for
people. Yeah, we get that from a lot of different people, of course. Thank you very much for this. Before we break up, I would like to give each and every one of you who are not part of our organization, so to say, including Larry, a chance of giving a minute or two about the final comments you have. And I would like to start with you, Osman. You have asked to participate here, and would like to hear your views.
I think it was, thank you for that. I'm here on behalf of CSER, and you will have received our comment letter. I think the two key points that we kind of submitted was the application of the requirements to long-term contracts, and it was very interesting to hear about the various views that we discussed on the topic one. I think we have very much a similar concern that were expressed about how it apply on the continuous third percentage of completion. So we look forward to see how that develops. On the other topic that we raised for discussion was on the credit risk affecting revenue recognition. And similar to the comments that were raised here, we raise it in the context of what's useful for users, and we don't have a strong view, but we feel that there needs to be more communication with users to see what they find useful and if it should be deducted from revenue or whether it should remain as useful information to keep it within the bad debt provision, the bad debt line, sorry.
Okay. Let's go around the table. Start with you, Andrew. Any final comment?
Thank you, yeah. Actually, I think there's a great deal to commend in this proposed draft, and tremendous progress has been made since the 2008 discussion paper, so congratulations to all involved on that. Nonetheless, I think you mentioned at the start of the show that the aim is still to finish this by midway through next year, and looking at your 950 comment letters and the output of these events, and I think critically the need to actually analyse all of that and carry out adequate field testing, that does look like kind of ambitious. If it can get done, then that's tremendous, but I hope that the boards won't sacrifice quality at the altar of timing.
Well, once again, commend all the efforts so far. We do very much support the objective of developing a standard on revenue recognition that would address comprehensively the principles involved in the revenue recognition process. Our main concern is that while the approach that you adopted, control-based approach, is definitely the right approach, and we agree with that, would we worry that for a revenue recognition standard to be easy to apply in practice and producing consistent results, people actually need to understand the principle involved extremely well. So it needs to be articulated very well and to be applicable in practice. It is a counterintuitive sort of concept. It's not a natural sort of meaning of the word control to apply it in certain areas of revenue recognition, and that's why the dialogue around services, I think, because it's not natural to think of control when you talk about services. It's okay to talk about assets and control, very difficult when you talk about service delivery. So articulation is key. What do you mean in those areas? And that is why we think for this standard to be successful, that is the one area where you need to put most of your efforts. We've got a lot of detailed comments, but it all boils down to the fact that you need to articulate what you mean by control very well. And the indicators as they stand today, they need considerably more work, and I don't think they are the only indicators that are applicable, and we have talked about that. I made some of those points earlier on.
For municipal elements arrangements, it's our main concern or question, and it's on the measurement of it, on the allocation to various performance obligations. So that is the standalone selling price definition that should be more precise, probably in any future standards, for comparability, as I've already mentioned. And we need absolutely to fix this also when there is a discount at inception of the transaction. be that is our main area of concern.
I don't think I've got a huge amount more to add. I think this conversation is very interesting from my point of view, and I think the key areas, the key difficulties that you as a board face have been very well illustrated in the discussions we've had this morning, because we have addressed what are the most difficult areas. But I don't have anything to add to my earlier comments.
Yes. I would say that the most important thing from our point of view is that revenue is an item which is accounted for by every single company. So this is a standard doing which applies to every IFRS company and perhaps others as well. So all I think our main concern is that you should not bring in too much complexity into the standard. We should try and keep it as simple as possible. We certainly agree with a single standard based on the control concept. But I think you need to look at dividing up performance obligations. I think trying to minimise that to those cases where it's absolutely essential. And I would also ask you to look at the disclosures that, again, you'll be asking every single company using IFRS to comply with. So I think our overall view is supportive, but just try to where you can reduce the complexity of application.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've clearly concentrated here on refinements that people suggested, general ones, and obviously we've articulated some industry-specific ones, which I won't rehearse, but it is important to recognise that the ISB's clearly taken on board the comments that they had from the discussion documents, and producing a 23-page draft standard is, in our view, a considerable technical achievement. It means we've had such a focused discussion here. Picking up the point that the FASB member made, I must say we do strongly believe there should be one standard that's applicable to all activities and without carve-outs for specific activities. And you know, we think you're well over halfway there.
My name is Lant, Association of Accounting Technicians. I'd just like to congratulate the ISB on the existing exposure draft. The AAT also supports a single standard that's applicable to both goods and services. A lot of issues that have been raised here today as well, both theoretical and practical, just have identified some certain issues. So our view is that I think there is some tweaking to be done with the existing standard, but I'm sure that the IASB will succeed in that. Thank you.
I think it's been immensely interesting this morning and just listening to other colleagues. Hopefully you've learned just a little bit about cooperatives. I think the only other thing that I'd like to say is obviously regarding disclosure that, you know, accounts preparers are really struggling with the increased demands being placed on them at the moment, and I think just please bear that in mind. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we remain very supportive of the direction the board's taken. We think this is a big step forward. We support the single model, and we support a lot of the principles that the board has articulated behind the model as it is. I think the two areas that we might encourage the board to focus on. One is around practicality. There are some aspects of it around perhaps time value of money, warranties, the requirement for retrospective application, where the boards might just reflect on whether there are some aspects that might be conceptually pure but will put pressure on people and just might like to factor in the practicalities. And secondly, that I think reflects this morning's discussion, we're comfortable with most of the principles, but we wonder whether the indicators around some of them, such as control and identifying distinct performance obligations, might be strengthened in a way that will give people greater clarity when they come to apply it.
April, anything you'd like to?
So, thank you very much for coming. I sense that I want to try to summarize this. It's too complicated. We have another 950 letters to consider. But I'm sensing that there's a lot of support for the direction, that there is a lot of work still to do, and a number of adjustments and possible adjustments to consider. We have had a lot of interaction in between the exposure draft and today. And all of these different meetings have given us, let's say, mental preparedness for a number of these questions. And I don't know if I dare say on behalf of my board colleagues, but I take the chance of saying that. I think we have a rather open mind to a couple of these very important questions. And I think it's quite likely that in the coming months we will be able to come out with a acceptable solution to this very, very important topic. Top line growth is, I think, the first thing a lot of investors look at, and the top line is running the whole analysis of a business. So we are very, very aware of the importance of this project, and therefore thank you very, very much for your support and your participation, and we trust that we can come back to you from time to time and ask for more comments and more advice. Thank you.